I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the just-completed 2013 session of the Indiana General Assembly. We'll discuss what got done and what didn't get done, who got helped and who got hurt, and what it means for Hoosiers as we all move ahead. I'll have with me two great guests, my colleagues Eric Bradner, State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press, and Leslie Weidenbender, Managing Editor of thestatehousefile.com. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about the just-completed 2013 session of the Indiana General Assembly today. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Got a couple of great guests here, both of whom I work with on a regular basis in the interest of full disclosure. Eric Bradner, who is the State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press, also my guest host when I'm not here, and he also works with us at the State House File as well. Eric, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Does it feel a little weird not to be in this chair now? Or is
a little
it
bit weird, a little but that's
strange?
All right.
Okay,
all right.
That's good. And Leslie Weidenbender, who also works with me at the State House File, where she is the managing editor. Leslie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Certainly. Well, this, after the past couple of legislative sessions here, it was a relatively quiet one, at least to outsiders. What I'm going to start with kind of a basic question, then we'll drill down into some of the areas. What will people remember most? What will be the legacy of this session? Eric, I'll start with you.
Well, it was Mike Pence's first session as governor, and so that's kind of going to be what it's remembered as, his first go-around with the General Assembly. So Indiana works in these two-year cycles, right? Write a two-year budget and then come back for a short session the next year. This is a long budget session, so the biggest, most important thing legislators had to do was write a new two-year budget worth about $30 billion in state general fund spending. What Pence wanted was an income tax cut. He wanted to lower the state's income tax rate by 10%, and legislators were hesitant about that. They were not confident that the state could afford that dip in revenue over the long run. So what they gave him was half the tax cut over twice the time. They gave him a 5% income tax cut phased in part at the beginning of 2015 and then in part at the beginning of 2017, as opposed to what he really wanted, which was the 10% tax cut, so twice as big, phased in this year and next year. So
yeah, in some ways it sort of reminds me of that old character in the Popeye cartoons, Wimpy, who would, you know, beg for a hamburger today that he would pay for tomorrow.
Gladly pay you Tuesday.
Yeah, for. Leslie, what do you think is going to be the legacy or what people will remember about this session?
I think that there's, frankly, it won't be very memorable, and I think that was by intention in many ways. After 2 years of arguing about the right to work and other union legislation, I think lawmakers wanted a timeout. I think they wanted to have a session where there wasn't a lot of things going on. Frankly, even after 8 years of Mitch Daniels, where they were challenged every year with big proposals, I think they actually wanted a year that was a little quieter. Several of the lawmakers commented about how much less stressed they were without the union protests going on outside. So I don't think it will be remembered for a lot outside of what Eric mentioned, which was Mike Pence's first session. And I think probably that most of them are okay with that.
Yeah, you wrote a column for the State House File where it, as a wrap-up thing where you talked about sort of a kinder, gentler session where legislators who had been kind of at each other's throats over right to work and all of that had resumed speaking to each other again.
Sure.
And were kind of grateful that some of the old conviviality had returned.
Sure, but I mean, part of the reason that was possible was because the Republicans weren't really pushing very hard on a lot of things. I think if you had seen an even greater expansion of vouchers, for example, where they tried to just open up vouchers to everyone, which I think there are Republicans who want to do, if they had pushed harder on a social agenda, if they'd gone forward with the marriage constitutional amendment, those things, I don't think it would have been nearly as people wouldn't have gotten along so well. So, I mean, they, you know, Brian Bosma, the speaker, talked at the end of the session about how he hopes this sets a new tone going forward. But I don't think it does. I think it was a timeout. It was a break that people needed. But I don't think that means that, I mean, these people are on different sides of the issues and they're going to continue to fight about them.
We've talked about the fact that right now that the legacy, as it were, what people are going to remember is that it was Mike Pence's first session as governor. How did he do? I mean, how did he come out of this session, Eric Bradner?
Well, Pence, both during the campaign and during his first session, made attacking this notion of a skills gap kind of a big focus. The idea that there are jobs out there that people are not qualified to fill. People don't have the training necessary to fill. And one of the reasons the session was toned down in terms of the partisan rhetoric was because there were some initiatives to attack that both sides agreed on. A renewed emphasis on vocational education in high schools, for example, an effort to realign state government by creating this new council that would sort of better sink the efforts in the workforce development and the education areas and so on. And I think that it's actually a good problem to look at, a good problem to try to attack, but the solutions that were approved this year are 2014-2015 solutions. They're not immediate solutions. This is something that takes some effort to launch and then some time to put into place. And I think that if Mike Pence is successful in the long term at increasing wages in Indiana relative to national averages and lowering the state's unemployment rate more quickly than Indiana's neighbors, I think if these vocational education efforts actually ultimately have an impact, then that could give us a much different perspective over the long run than we might have immediately after his first session. So that's kind of the big long-term question when we're considering what has happened lately. Yeah. However...
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, however, you know, if you look at his immediate success, I think, again, half the tax cut over twice as long. That's not great. That's with a Republican supermajority.
And kind of grudgingly offered.
Yeah,
that too.
Right. I think that he spent a lot of political capital on that. I think within the State House right now, his stock is probably lower than it is outside the building, where perhaps all people know about the governor so far is that he spent his first 4 months in office campaigning for a tax cut.
I did think we saw some quick maturing, though, of the governor. You know, in the first few weeks of the session, he didn't want to say what he thought about any bills that weren't part of his agenda. He didn't want to be specific about his agenda. And then, as you saw, he said he was going to wait until legislation got to his desk to decide what he thought about it. And I don't know if someone pulled him aside or, you know, if he just sort of figured out along the way that's you can't really do that.
Yeah, you don't blindside legislators.
No, you've got to be part of the process, especially in a state, frankly, where your veto doesn't mean that much. I mean, lawmakers in Indiana can override a governor's veto with a simple majority. And so if you want to make an impact on legislation, you have to get in there and get your people in there and do that right away. And you saw that by the end of the session, I mean, he was doing that. He was involved in the budget and the tax process. He was involved in some utility legislation. He was involved in the voucher legislation, and he had a huge impact on the gambling legislation that passed. And so I think that he went from really not quite knowing what he was doing when he got started to actually, you know, having a real impact by the end. They aren't necessarily the things that he's going to run around and talk about, but they are things that that are important.
We are talking about the just completed session of the Indiana General Assembly. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, Leslie, I'm going to stay with you for a second. What about the governor's performance surprised you in this session? And maybe say two things. One that surprised you on the upside, a skill that you wouldn't have perceived that he might have had coming in, and one that surprised you on the downside. You would have thought he might have grasped that a little more quickly or you know, been able to exert some impact. And
I guess I was a little surprised right off the bat that he and the other Republicans didn't seem to be quite on the same page. And I actually think that goes back into the campaign. I'm not sure that the campaign that Mike Pence was running was actually coordinating at all with the legislative leaders. And I think that turned out to be important. I mean, we learned during the session that Brian Bosma had, I think, 45-minute notice that the governor, the then candidate Pence, was going to make a recommendation for a 10% tax cut. Well, they had some pretty strong feelings about that. And, you know, if he had let them in on some of those things at the beginning, I think that they could have had an influence. And those kinds of things could have been worked out even before, you know, while he was running. And then he could have come in. They could have gotten passed immediately. So, but I actually do think he figured it out. I think he was so intent on respecting the legislative process since he has been a congressman, and the legislative process is what he knew. He was so intent on respecting them that he forgot that they do look to him for some leadership. And so even these guys who were sort of eager to be their own leaders, they still need him to weigh in, and I think he figured it out.
Eric Bradner.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, there were some situations where Pence's rhetoric early in the session was just lacking a layer of nuance, and he was getting himself into a little bit of trouble. I remember as he was talking about whether the state would expand Medicaid, he was criticizing the administration of the program. Well, that's something that the state handles a big part of.
Mm-hmm.
He was criticizing his own administration when he did that. I think his rhetoric got more nuanced. I think he grew to understand a lot of issues better over the course of the session, and you saw that in his dealings with the legislature as he got really involved, especially over the last 6 weeks or so, perhaps in issues like gambling, utility issues. So he grew a lot. I think that his administration might have expected to enter office with something comparable to the political capital that Mitch Daniels left office with.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was why he didn't feel like he needed to vet some of his proposals with legislative leaders beforehand, because he sort of thought, you know, the governor enters office with the strength to get some of these things done.
He expected a honeymoon, too, which is not unreasonable.
Well, yeah, but, yeah, you know, Mike Pence and Mitch Daniels are two very different people.
And he's suffering some from the from the Mitch Daniels era. I mean, Mitch Daniels had very aggressive agendas. He told lawmakers what he wanted done, and he did have an incredible amount of political capital and savvy to get a lot of those things done. Also, Mitch Daniels came in when the Republicans were in the House, were newer in their leadership and in their majorities. Now the Republicans have super majorities in both the House and Senate. They don't need the governor as much, and they were so eager to be leaders outside of Mitch Daniels that I think they really weren't prepared to be listening to Mike Pence very much either. And so I actually think this situation came from both sides, and they kind of came together in the end.
Yeah, I don't spend as much time, obviously, at the State House as the two of you, but when I would run into lawmakers, several of them thoughtfully were saying, without attempting to make comparisons between Pence and Daniels, that some of the balance between the legislative and executive branches needed to be readjusted, redressed was that part of what was going on as well, Eric Bradner?
It was definitely part of what was going on. Legislators would say as much. I think on an intellectual level, Mike Pence knew that following Mitch Daniels was going to be a tough challenge. I think he knew that Republicans liked Mitch Daniels a lot, that he had high approval ratings, but I don't think he quite grasped the practical impact of that, what that meant in terms of how he would have to deal with the legislature. On the other hand, Mitch Daniels left office very popular, and he's not going to get more popular. I think we've already started to see some Daniels initiatives grow less popular among legislators, among Republicans. I think there's a sense that Daniels got a lot of things done quickly, and so now it's time to evaluate things. And so I think the time is becoming more appropriate for someone like Pence. I think that he's going to start to overcome those Daniels comparisons now.
We are talking about the just completed session of the Indiana General Assembly. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'm talking with my colleagues Eric Bradner and Leslie Weidenbender. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the Indiana General Assembly, which just wrapped up its work for 2013. My guests are Eric Bradner, the Evansville Courier and Press, and Leslie Weidenbender, the managing editor of thestatehousefile.com. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Got a couple of tweets. One from a listener named Don saying, can Eric Bradner talk briefly about the importance of the Rockport deal and what that means for Hoosiers?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good question.
And I don't think we have to limit it. Eric's not the only one who's allowed to talk on
expert.
This, Leslie. Okay.
Well, this is a really important issue because if the Rockport project goes forward, 17% of everybody in Indiana who uses gas, every gas customer would have their bills impacted by that project and by whether the rates associated with that project are better than open market rates. So just to quickly recap what happened here. A couple of years ago, Mitch Daniels' administration negotiated a 30-year contract to buy and then resell the synthetic natural gas produced at a plant in Rockport, Indiana.
Probably ought to tell people where that is.
Which is in southern Indiana. It's east of Evansville, along the Ohio River. The idea of the plant is pretty simple. It's, you know, in a time of volatile natural gas prices, the plant would use Indiana coal and Ohio River water to produce a product that would be cheaper over the long run. Well, then this sort of nationwide shale gas boom happened, and now projections are that natural gas prices might stay cheaper longer, and therefore the pre-negotiated rates associated with this Rockport plant would force people to pay more than they might have otherwise. And there's a great debate on whether that's true or not, but regardless, legislators were entering this session under pressure from consumer advocacy groups, from utilities, especially Vectren, from the Indiana Chamber, from the Indiana Manufacturers Association, to somehow get out of this Rockport deal. They were arguing that the contract would just impose too much of a burden on people, and so they were trying to find a way to do that. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the Rockport project is embroiled in this legal battle where Vectren, that same group, is trying to get the Indiana Supreme Court now to force changes to the contract, to reject the contract, that sort of thing. So what legislators decided to do was kind of defer to that court process in a way that requires developers to win, and I mean they have to really win in the Supreme Court. It's kind of unlikely since the Court of Appeals already to some extent sided with the opponents of the project. But if the developers don't win in the Supreme Court, then as a result of this year's session, the entire project would go back to state regulators for another really tough round of reviews with a new set of standards that didn't exist when the project was initially developed. And so the problem for these developers is they don't think they can meet these new standards. They don't think they can jump through these hoops because the contract never would have been negotiated in the way that it was in the first place had the hoops been in place. So it's really a life or death scenario for this project in the Supreme Court right now. And that's because of what legislators did. What legislators did was pass a measure that doesn't necessarily kill the project outright, mm-hmm. but gets pretty darn close to it. And that's something that a lot of consumer advocacy groups and whatnot are very happy about.
We are talking about the Indiana General Assembly and what it did this past session here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. And we've gotten another tweet from a listener named Michaela. This one's directed toward Leslie. And ask you to explain a little bit about the gambling issues she's talking about Governor Pence being involved in.
Well, the gambling issues really come down to the competition that that casinos in Indiana are facing from other states. And particularly, this has been exacerbated by new casinos in Ohio. There's a new casino that opened in Cincinnati, and they already that casino has dropped revenues in southeastern Indiana by some 20%, 25%. And that's going to be a big hit on Indiana's gambling revenues. The casinos want to make some changes. They want to be able to have a tax break or pay no taxes on what's called promotional play or free play. That's when, like, John, if they send you a coupon that says you can have $50 of gambling at French Lick if you come down and stay at the hotel. That right now they pay taxes on that when they send it, and they pay taxes on that when you use it. And so it's sort of a double taxation problem. So they wanted to get rid of that. Some of the casinos wanted to rebuild. The riverboats wanted to rebuild on land. Maybe one of the biggest proposals was one to allow the horse track casinos, which are in Anderson and Shelbyville, to switch from electronic gaming table games to dealer-based table games. So if you can imagine, there's a computer there, it's dealing you blackjack. They want to have a real dealer dealing you blackjack. That's not allowed currently under state law, and they wanted live dealers. They said they could create a lot of jobs if they did that. But Mike Pence stepped in and said that the Senate went along with most of those, but Mike Pence stepped in and said he thought that was an expansion of gambling, both the moving the boats onto land and also the live dealers. And so the House stripped most of that out. Brian Bosma also had some questions about whether that was an expansion. There was a lot of adamant opposition that it was not an expansion, but in the end, Mike Pence won that battle. And basically, the main thing that the gambling bill now does is offer the tax break on free play. It gives a few other tax breaks to smaller casinos, but it doesn't allow any of those so-called expansions.
And somewhere, at some point in all of this, also, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway got involved in the mix, too. Could we talk a little bit about what happened there?
Well, the IMS wants to... let me back up. First of all, the federal government's requiring the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to make some changes to try to make their facility more accommodating to people with disabilities. So they have that. They also want to add some lights and do quite a few other projects to upgrade the facility, add more races, and be able to race at night. And so they came to the legislature to seek some help for that. Lawmakers looked at a loan, and at some point, a lawmaker suggested some of the money come out of gambling revenues. So the two issues got tied together, and there was a lot of concern about that. And in the end, that ended up getting stripped out. The issues are actually totally separate now. But the racing bill, the auto racing bill, really evolved.
There were several
racing bills. But the auto racing bill really evolved, and now it doesn't just provide a loan and some assistance to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, but it also creates a loan fund to help other motorsports companies throughout the state.
So that's it. We've mentioned also that there was some activity in regard to school vouchers. What happened there, Eric Bradner? And that seemed to be the one actually that generated if there was heat in this session.
Yeah,
that
sure.
was a fair bit of it. That we didn't see any crowds the size of the ones for Right to Work and all of that, but they did. Both sides brought crowds in.
Well, and what was interesting is that the House and the Senate were really nowhere near on the same page with this. The House was advocating a pretty significant expansion of the voucher program, whereas the Senate kind of wanted to hit the brakes a bit, see how what Indiana already had in place worked out. So what they eventually did, and it ended up being somewhat complicated, but so originally you had to meet income guidelines and you had to spend 1 year in public school in order to qualify for vouchers. Now, if you live in a district where you would attend a public school that earns an F rating on the state's accountability scale, you don't have to do that 1 year in public school. Instead, you can qualify for a voucher right away, again, as long as you meet the income guidelines. Also, there are now higher income limits for, I believe, the families of military veterans and children with disabilities and foster children. So they can more easily qualify for vouchers.
Is this a case where, you know, to some degree, as you say, the Senate wanted to put the brakes on? And I know there was an exchange at one point in the session when Bob Boehning was testifying and Luke Kinley, in effect, said, you know, shouldn't we find out whether these things are actually working before we, I guess since we were talking about gambling, double down here? Shouldn't we have some evidence or collect some evidence beforehand? And, you know, to some degree, it seemed like, okay, the issue's going away for a year. Will it be back?
I think it will. At this point, there are two types of Republicans. There are those who think, and Mike Pence is one of these types, that believe school choice in and of itself should be the state's aim. That as long as parents have the decision, then whether a voucher actually leads that parent's child to get a better education or not, you know, the beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and that it should be entirely up to the parent. There are others who see this really as a project that was intended to get low-income students who attend struggling schools a chance to get a better education, and if they're not getting a better education, then the whole thing isn't worthwhile.
Yeah, it's almost as if the argument is, on one side, it is just a parent's right, period.
Right.
That you can send your child wherever you want to. You ought to be able to dictate that based, you know, regardless of whether you have the means to make those choices or not, personal means. Mm-hmm. The argument is that it's a government-driven means here. And then the other school, which is still, they're still voucher advocates, are arguing that this is a way to achieve a goal, and we need to see, to test it and see. We are talking about the Indiana General Assembly and what it did during the 2013 session here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, or you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. We've gotten an email question from a listener that actually speaks to some of the points that you've alluded to. Says, listener's name is Jerry, says, considering its inherent deficiencies, the recently concluded Indiana state legislative session was not nearly as bad as it might have been. Do you guests think that the legislature's refusal simply to adopt Governor Pence's 10% income tax is a valid indicator that some actual thinking occasionally occurs within the Republican supermajorities? I'm guessing this person is not a Republican.
Yeah, I think you'll find that when you talk to reporters, we will tell you there are thinking people on both sides and there are unthinking people on both sides. So I don't think you're going to find us saying that there are not unthinking people in the Republican Party. I think the fact that they didn't give the governor his 10% is a product of many of the things we've already talked about. I think it has to do with not wanting to give the governor, not wanting to give him total control right off the bat. I think it has to do with them wanting to exert their own influence over the tax cuts that they truly believe are more important.
Yeah, the inheritance tax.
The inheritance tax, the financial institutions tax. But in addition, I think that these, unlike a new governor, these lawmakers have been through ups and downs, and they recently went through a very, very difficult economy and times when they had to write budgets without much money, and they are very cautious about giving away some of their revenue. I realize taxpayers don't view it as the state's revenue. They view it as their own revenue. But in those budget writers' minds, they are giving up revenue when they give a tax cut. And I think they're very wary of doing that when they know that over the past few years, They've cut back on a lot of spending in education, for state parks, for general government services, and they're worried about that.
And if the economy takes another downturn, the last thing they want to do is have to go back and say, well, we got to increase taxes to keep the parks open or whatever. Jerry, in his email, also alludes to the supermajorities, you know, the quorum-proof majorities that both chambers had this year. I mean, the Senate's had one, since Moses was a child. But it was a relatively new development for the House. What changes did we see in the way this session played out because of those supermajorities? Leslie, I'm going to stay with you.
Well, I think it's a little bit hard to tell because I think the Democrats were a little tired of the walkout strategy that hadn't particularly worked for them the past few years. So I'm not sure that even if the Republicans had not won a quorum-proof majority, I'm not sure that the Democrats would have been walking out a lot. And so, I'm not sure how much it changed things. But there's no doubt, though, that that does affect Democrats pick their battles differently than they would if they were able to stop a session by leaving or by boycotting. But I also, interestingly, think Republicans were very concerned about looking like they were overreaching at a time when there was nothing Democrats could do about it. I think they didn't want to look like bullies. I think Brian Bosma in particular, the House Speaker, is very concerned about looking like a bully. And so I think he actually held back quite a bit on things that they might have otherwise done because he didn't want to take advantage of the supermajority. So sometimes these things have an interesting effect.
Yeah, I think Bosma specifically is the one where, you know, you really saw him sort of trying to be cautious, trying to avoid looking like he didn't care about Democrats or wasn't willing to give them the courtesy that a minority party would ordinarily receive, even though they had no actual power. I mean, all of us have said this before. Legislators are there when new governors get there, and they're still there when that governor is an old one and leaves. They do have to take a longer view because they know they're going to be involved in the budget writing process for a very long time, and they know that these things sort of ebb and flow, and Democrats are going to be back, and Democrats are going to remember how they were treated when they were in the super minority. So Bosma especially was cautious. I think David Long tried to be respectful of his Democratic colleagues as well. I think the leaders, at least, if not their caucuses, the leaders at least were very well aware of the downside of a supermajority.
Was it difficult for them to manage? You know, there's a theory among political scientists that when you have a supermajority, majority that large, that the factions then in effect become the minority party. Was that an issue for Brian Bosma and David Long, the leaders in the House and the Senate, respectively? Eric Bradner.
I don't think so this session. I think there were a couple of instances where the answer would have been yes. I think they did, you know, depending on how you look at it, a good job from their perspective and perhaps a bad job from the public's of keeping that behind closed doors. I know there were a few instances where their caucus was split, and they...
Which instances were those?
Rockport would be a great example. They were considering a bill that would have effectively, if not killed the project, then put it on very thin ice. And some members who were aligned with coal and or labor had an amendment that would have basically gutted the bill. And they offered that amendment on the House floor and succeeded. They got it passed, 48-42, and Speaker Bosma was surprised, I would say somewhat shocked that the amendment had passed. That sort of was a public display of that split within the party on how to handle that, on how coal and labor versus business would play out. So that's one example, but generally...
We'll have to pick up the next one after the break. We are talking about the Indiana General Assembly here on No Limits. My guests are Eric Bradner and Leslie Weidenpenner. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the just-completed session of the Indiana General Assembly. My guests are Eric Bradner of the Evansville Courier and Press and Leslie Weidenbender of thestatehousefile.com. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. And we've gotten a question from a listener named Marcia, came via Facebook, said, did the General Assembly make any decisions about Medicaid expansion? Eric Bradner.
Short answer is no. So for background here, President Obama's health care law envisioned states expanding their Medicaid programs, and for Indiana that would have meant about 400,000 more Hoosiers would have qualified. But the Supreme Court said states could opt out of that. Democrats badly wanted the General Assembly to pass some sort of measure saying that Indiana would expand Medicaid at least for the first 3 years under the federal health care law, given that the federal government will pay 100% of the costs over that period, even though that would be slowly phased down so that the federal government would pick up 90% of the tab and the state would handle the other 10%. So Democrats were pushing for that, but Mike Pence has said all along that he wants to consider a Medicaid expansion through the state's own Healthy Indiana plan, which is different from traditional Medicaid in that it includes health savings accounts that people have to pay a small share of their own income into and sort of manage their care from that health savings account. If they spend the entire account, which I believe is $1,100 per year, then a traditional insurance program that's funded by the state kicks in. But it's a different approach, and Pence has said all along that he favors the Healthy Indiana plan as the vehicle for an expansion. So his administration told the General Assembly that they don't need any new authority. They can ask the federal government to approve that and can negotiate with the federal government to approve the Healthy Indiana plan as that vehicle. And they're in the middle of doing that right now. And so the legislature was trying to find a way to sort of instruct the Pence administration to do that, but ultimately decided to take the governor's word for it and let Pence try to figure that out on his own.
Kick the can down the road until you have more information.
Well, there is a really interesting national debate going on, and it was kicked up by the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. When the U.S. Supreme Court decided states, you don't have to do this, mm-hmm. they sort of opened the doors for states to negotiate with the federal government. And the states have a lot of ideas. A lot of different states have been running different kinds of programs, mm-hmm. and they want to see if they can get as much flexibility as possible. Most of the states don't really like dealing with the federal government very much. I mean, it's not like they can get out of it. They've mm-hmm. got to continue with their regular Medicaid program, but they want to experiment around, and it's not clear yet how much flexibility the federal government's willing to give states. And so at this point, I don't think the Democrats really wanted the legislature to create a kind of backstop. So if the federal government doesn't go for what Pence wants, then the state would do a traditional Medicaid expansion. But I think Republicans aren't anywhere close to that yet. They want to see what other states can manage to negotiate.
Is some part of that because they know that is always an option. They can go back to that if they have
to. Yeah, it's always an option. I mean, and if you put that in the law, what possible
reason
would the federal government have for negotiating? So
we are talking about the just completed session of the Indiana General Assembly here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Connie, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
I have a question about the legislature's move to remove the four at-large candidates from the Marion County City County Council. When that issue first came up, I think people were really blindsided by it, that the legislature even had that authority. Matthew Tully, in his column in The Star, asked where all the outrage was. Well, believe me, there was a lot. We waited a few days to see who would write in. Terry Curry wrote a piece on the op-ed page that was very, very good. Shortly after that, the measure was deleted from a bill. And then time goes along, and it's back. You know, and Matthew Tully had also written a column that Brian Bosma had matured quite a lot as a leader. Many of us thought, you know, this thing would never go forward. What do your guests have to say about this little piece of legislation that really is quite a large piece of legislation?
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, Connie.
You're welcome.
Well, I will throw that to whoever wants it first. Leslie, you want to take it?
You know, Marion County is truly a unique creature of state government. No other city or community in Indiana has the kind of structure that Marion County has. It was created by the legislature, which is why the legislature has the power to make the changes. Not everybody agrees that's a good idea, but that is the way it's structured now. You know, this is pure politics. I mean, deep in that bill, there are reasons why the mayor may need more authority for this and that. But Republicans have pushed for this over the years, and Democrats have pushed for this over the years, both when it would have served their political purposes. And I think that's what you're seeing now. It is interesting that the governor is giving serious consideration, I think, to not signing this bill or vetoing this bill. I mean, I think if there's ever an opportunity for people to have some impact here, this would be a place. If you support this bill, this is a good time to call the governor. If you oppose this bill, it's a great time to call the governor. So,
yeah,
Eric Bradner.
If the General Assembly did anything this year that was nakedly political and in no way grounded in any sort of philosophical belief about anything, it was this bill. It's a power grab, plain and simple. There's no other way to look at it. And, you know, we were sort of praising Brian Bosman and David Long earlier for their willingness to pull back the reins and not dominate, exclude Democrats from conversations and whatnot. Well, this is an exception to that. This is clearly a power grab. And Leslie's right. The governor said a couple of days ago that he's not sure whether he'll sign the bill into law. I wouldn't be stunned if he vetoes it, because it is just a naked political move.
Speaking of sort of naked political moves, there was a fair bit of jousting early in the session between the newly elected state superintendent of public instruction and Republicans in the legislature. Did that calm down or continue on or get worse as the session went on? Eric Bradner.
I think it's a little bit too early to tell how that relationship's going to work. There are a lot of ways in which the new Democratic superintendent of public instruction, Glenda Ritz, and some Republican legislators are actually on the same page. They praised her, but part of the reason she earned their praises was because she played a pretty low-key role during the legislative session. And she probably won't be able to continue doing that for too much longer. So I think it's...
Why is that?
Well, there are just too many ways in which her office impacts education in Indiana, too many issues on which she'll need to weigh in. And keep in mind, she has to administer a lot of programs implemented by Republicans that she campaigned against. And so... whether she chooses to administer those programs faithfully or looks for ways to impact them will be a key question. And she's also talked about realigning the Department of Education to try to help local school districts some more and have regional liaisons and that kind of thing. So if she's making changes, then Republicans will naturally react to those.
I think the most fascinating relationship right now in politics is actually between the State Board of Education and everyone else. I mean, the State Board of Education is so frustrated. There was a meeting yesterday, and you could just feel the tension and anger that those board members who were appointed by Mitch Daniels, I think all of them appointed by Mitch Daniels, that how mad they are that people are now questioning their decisions about the way they grade schools and adopting the Common Core. And the legislature has put a pause on Common Core, which is this set of standards that are being adopted across the country. And so it's interesting. I mean, Glenda Ritz sided with lawmakers, with the majority of lawmakers, at least on the point about pausing Common Core And they are mad at her about it. The state board yesterday was blaming her for it, even though it was the Republican lawmakers who actually ended up putting that thing in place. So I think that relationship's really interesting, and it's going to get even more fascinating because the governor, Pence, is about to replace or about to appoint 6 of the 10 members, and he can reappoint some of those folks or he can put a whole new crew in there. And I don't think that it's fair to say, I don't think Mike Pence aligns on education the way Mitch Daniels did. And,
yeah, Pence is a key question here.
Philosophically, you know, because he's probably more, we were talking earlier, like on the voucher stuff, where he sees it more as a parent's right rather than, you know,
but he also doesn't like he's not sure what he thinks about the Common Core standards because he doesn't like the idea that Indiana's adopting something that's being adopted in other states. What was that phrase he used about 6 times yesterday? We're going to do Indiana education Indiana's way, or something.
And what that means. Yeah, Pence has been, I mean, his language on education is very boilerplate. He hasn't really had to dig into any of the details. And these board appointments are going to be the first instance where we really get to sort of understand his philosophy as implemented through other people, through actors appointed by him. So he's finally going to have to get beyond there's nothing that ails Indiana education that can't be cured by giving parents more choices and teachers more freedom to teach. So
that's his standard line. He's used it so many times.
Yeah.
And we don't know what that means.
No.
I mean, you have a sense of what it means, but really, I mean, you just don't have any idea. And so that's all playing out right now at the state board. And you know, no, I don't think most of us have paid that much attention to the state board for years. But this comes back to the superintendent of public instruction race. And when Glenda Ritz beat Tony Bennett, that was a big, loud ring across the state for all Republicans to think about how far they want to go on some of these issues. And the state board is angry about it.
Well, and Mitch Daniels, who was still governor at the time, kind of marched those folks out into the middle of the battlefield at that point by saying, really doesn't matter. The state superintendent of public instruction answers to the state board of education, and I appointed all of those folks. So
now, there's also, to game this out a little bit further, most Republicans in the General Assembly did vote for the Daniels education reforms. So while they might be pulling back on the reins a little bit right now, if a new state board with new members makes too many changes, then perhaps the legislature reacts to those changes next year.
Yeah,
given all of this, how are they going to get anybody to serve on that board? I mean, that sounds like being the rope in a tug-of-war.
No, that's true. But I'll tell you, there are a lot of people out there interested in education. I think Pence is going to have some really fascinating appointments.
Who are, out of this, it's probably the trite question, but since we're getting close to the end of the hour, it's the one to ask. Winners and losers coming out of this session. It can be either the political figures or, you know, ordinary Hoosiers. I mean, what demographic groups here in the state did well or didn't do well? I'll start with you, Eric.
Okay, I'll throw out one winner. The Indiana Farm Bureau didn't get the ag gag bill, but they did get the inheritance tax eliminated immediately, which is big for family farms. They got some soil productivity factor changes, and those are probably more complicated than I could even explain or that we have time for, but those save farmers from some tax increases, some property tax increases that would have otherwise come. They opposed the Rockport project, and they got a bill that they really like on that. So that's one organization that had a pretty good year.
I'm going to go for Indiana Equality and all the folks who support same-sex marriage, and or even if they don't support same-sex marriage, oppose a constitutional amendment. The legislature just decided to wait on that another year. Next year, they could still put that on the ballot next year, but I think it's clear that public opinion is changing quickly on same-sex marriage issues. So by waiting another year, it makes it somewhat less likely that thing will pass. And so I think that's a big victory for those people who oppose that marriage amendment.
Who are the losers? I'll stay with you, Leslie. Who are the big losers this time around?
Well, I mean, I think you have to say, you know, generally Democrats are losers because they didn't have the power to do anything. I don't think they did anything wrong at all. But in fact, I think they made a pretty good case. They tried to talk about the middle class a lot. I thought they chose some good strategy. But, I mean, they just didn't have any power. They didn't get any of the things they really wanted. They didn't get Medicaid. They didn't get that they would not have wanted a lot of these tax provisions. So, you know, I would say Democrats generally.
Yeah, I'll throw out two of them, the hospitals, mm-hmm. which wanted the Medicaid expansion, and casinos, especially the two racinos in Anderson and Shelbyville, wanted the live table games, didn't get them, and they're not going to in the near future, as long as Pence is in office. Some of the riverboats wanted the ability to move on to land that they already own. They didn't get that. So I think legislators are finally starting to understand that while casino revenue is important, it's really not that important.
In terms of the issue that we've spent a lot of time on here in this on No Limits, we've had several shows dedicated to it. What happened with mass transit? What's likely to happen with mass transit?
Mass transit went to a study committee. You know, the House, this was the second time the House had considered this issue. The Senate literally ignored it until they had to think about it. They didn't think it would pass the House. I think they literally ignored all of the issues. And so then all of a sudden when it was put in front of them, I think they really didn't understand it very well. They weren't sure about it. They didn't know how to proceed. And I don't think they wanted to vote it down. So instead they sent it to a study committee. And we'll see. We'll see what will happen. I do think it's notable that that Governor Mike Pence has let one bill become law without his signature, and that was a local tax increase. That was a local food and beverage tax increase, which makes me wonder whether Governor Pence would be willing to go along with a mass transit bill eventually, because it would allow for a tax increase through a referendum.
I will say advocates of mass transit are bad at lobbying the Indiana General Assembly. They just do not speak the language of Senate Republicans, and they've got to get better at that, or else the thing's never going to happen.
And their Senate is the Senate's the hump for them here.
It is.
But they did make some real gains, though. They did get it through the House, which
this
I don't
is true.
Three or four months ago, I wouldn't have said that was going to happen.
We've got about 30 seconds left here. Real quickly, what's going to be the biggest issue of the next session? Real quickly, Eric.
Gay marriage.
One way or the other, they've got to decide on it this time.
Medicaid.
So the next session could be far more contentious than this quiet, gentle,
Absolutely.
Almost placid one we had here.
Gay marriage will be bigger than this session in its entirety.
And will we see crowds like we had for Right to Work and all of that in the same
I don't think they'll be that big, but I do agree. I think that there's going to be a lot going on about the same-sex marriage issue.
If it goes to the ballot, more money than the governor's race.
Oh, man. We have just wrapped up talking about the Indiana General Assembly. I'd like to thank my guest, Eric Bradner, who is also my guest host upon occasion. Eric, thanks. Always good to have you here.
Thank you.
And Leslie Weidenbender, who works with me at the State House File. Leslie, it's really good to talk with you as always.
Thanks so much for having me.
Certainly. Thank you. We will be back next week with two new shows. Thank you for joining us.